Welcome to episode 39 of Upshift, No Direction Network's podcast that gives you an edge on Essence 20. I'm Ryan Casello, one of the designers of the Essence 20 system and an author on the G.I. Joe Transformers and My Little Pony role-playing game core rulebooks, as well as over a dozen other Essence 20 products from Renegade Game Studios. Before we begin, although I have worked for Renegade on Essence 20, Upshift is not associated with or produced by Renegade Game Studios. This is not an official Essence 20 podcast, and all opinions shared herein are my own or my guests. Yes, we have a guest today. Now, just to give you some context, a lot of my friends in the G.I. Joe fandom think that my getting to write on the brand is a big deal, and I do agree with them, but I'm no Jim Sorensen. I never converted glyphs seen on screen into a functional language and typeface. I haven't authored almost a dozen guides to Transformers characters, art, and history. The biggest feather in my cap is just the latest for Jim, who has contributed to the last two Transformers RPG source books. So we're here to talk about all that and more with today's guest, Jim Sorensen.
Well, thank you very much for having me. That is a big intro to live up to, and I will do my level best to do so.
Okay, well, let's pull back and just start with something simple. Transformers are great, right?
I love Transformers. I think they're pretty awesome. You know, I was exactly in the Target demo when they came out in 1984. The GoBots pilot had aired, and then the Transformers had a commercial for the comic book, which was a whole thing to get around, like, you know, FCC, they're not airplanes, FCC regulations about how much animation you could have in toy commercials. So they advertised their Transformers comic on TV. They did the same exact thing with G.I. Joe, as I'm sure you know. And the commercial worked. Everybody in my elementary school, I was about eight, so I guess I was in second or third grade. You know, we were really stoked by these transforming robots. And we, even though the commercial was ostensibly for a comic book, like, we could read between the lines, and we all demanded our parents take us out to the store to go try and find the Transformers. And I went looking with my mom for Optimus Prime, which we could not find, but we got a Prowl because I thought a police car was still pretty cool. And, sort of went from there. And, I never really fell out of love with Transformers. Like, all through high school, I was into them. Right when I was starting to age out and the cartoon went off the air, the comic books got really good. Simon Furman, a British writer, took over writing duties of Marvel US and really expanded the scope of the Transformers comics to be really cosmic and mythological. And I responded, yeah, I was right, exactly the right, I was about 13 or so, to respond to that level of story engagement. And then the toys sort of went away, and then they came back as Generation 2, and that was super exciting. And then they kind of, you know, they tried to freshen up the old cartoon with new computer, really awful computer graphics in the 90s, and that didn't quite work. But then Beast Wars came out, and while I was in college, and lo and behold, they were really good. And, you know, you alluded to this, but I went through the Beast Wars cartoon, and, you know, I taped it on VHS. I had a TV VCR unit that I would carry from my dorm room into the common area where there was a cable hookup, and I would unhook the main TV and hook up mine, and I would record Beast Wars episodes, and then I'd have to do it. And I did the same thing for Exo Squad, which is a great cartoon from the 90s. And then I'd go back to my room, and one day for procrastination, I wound up, I made a website for like a class as an assignment, and it was about science fiction fonts. And I found all the ones I could find and I put them online. But a lot of the stuff I was interested in didn't have fonts like that were TrueType and that you could download. So I wound up making fonts for like Predator and like The Last Starfighter, the Rylodian language. And I did that for Beast Wars and for the original series. I made an Autobot font based on the episode Cosmic Rust, and I made a Decepticon font based on the comic book Decepticon. Graffiti was the name of the font. That might have been the name, the issue of the comic, but Decepticons, the run of Mock and Runabout, the battle chargers were going around defacing human monuments, and I turned those into fonts. And the ancient Autobot font has been picked up, and it's all over the packaging today. It's in Transformers 1, so that was very gratifying. But the Beast Wars stuff, they had very precise, specific fonts because it was all computers and they could do that. And they corresponded one-to-one with the Roman character set, and I was able to figure out like a cryptic quote what they were. I think the first one I got was maximal for shield failure because they were saying the shields are failing and they're flashing, a bunch of characters on the screen. I'm like, well, if that's shield failure, oh yeah, because the eye would be here and here, yeah, that lines up and worked from there. And there are a couple of screens where the alphabet scrolls by in order, and that makes it especially easy.
You've surely by now talked to some of the people that worked on the show. How did they feel about the level of detail and just the puzzle solving that you put into your Beast Wars watching?
Well, I think they directly addressed it because there's an episode of Beast Machines where a little bit of Predacon text scrolls by on a Viacon, and it says, "If you can read this, seek help." I have to assume that was personally directed because after it, when that episode would come out, I would post little translations online of all the text. And a lot of times they would be sort of diegetic elements like shield failure, but sometimes they'd be little in jokes. I think one of them said, "Hey, Ian, go F yourself." They didn't censor it.
Who's
And Ian
Ian?
Cor Ian Corlett, I assume, plays
Okay.
Cheetor. So I guess one of the actors pissed off one of the animators. Or it's been a long time since I've had sweet thistle pie. So whatever was floating their boat at the time. And yeah, I wound up writing a couple of Transformers books based on the animation models for IDW, and they sold really well. So I wound up doing something similar for Transformers Animated, but because unlike the original Transformers cartoon from the 80s, where I had to go spelunking and trying to uncover old character models, which was a pain in the ass, the Transformers Animated was on the air. And I lived in California, so I would just drive to Burbank and I'd have a portable hard drive and I'd hand it to them and I'd say, "Oh, give me all your animation models." And they'd say, "Okay, there you go. Do you need anything else?" "Give me all your scripts." "Okay, there you go. What else?" "Give me all your story." I mean, I just asked for anything I could think of and got a ton of it. It allowed me a lot of freedom because in the first couple of books I was doing, I was just trying to find the material. That was all of my effort. But because I didn't have to do any sleuthing for animated, I had a lot more energy, and I was working with a guy named Bill Forster, still a good buddy of mine, and we just had a lot more time to put our own creative spin into the material. So there's a lot more text, there's a lot more narrative elements to it. We got to create some of our own artistic elements to go alongside what was going for the show, and we really, instead of just documenting model sheets, we really got to expand the corners of the universe. And we were really fortunate that the head writer Marty Eisenberg and the art director, the late great Derek Wyatt, were able to give us their input on our contributions, which was really pretty necessary because sometimes I'd write something and I'd get a note from Marty saying, oh, for Lugnut, make sure that the subject of every sentence he says is Megatron, which was a terrific note. He's like, don't say Starscream is fast, say Starscream's speed serves Megatron's agenda. I'm like, oh, okay, I get it. And you could see why he was in the position he was in, because he was able to very succinctly and clearly direct me in a way that made the character much more authentic than it would have been otherwise. And that was just a great experience. And I've been doing Transformers books and some other properties ever since. We were chatting before about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I did the art book for the Mutant Mayhem book last summer, so that was pretty cool. And I love working on the Transformers role-playing books. A buddy of mine had been doing work for Renegade, and they were looking for freelance Transformers writers, and he said he wasn't really up to it, but he knew a guy who might be. And they brought me in, and they really let me go wild. I thought maybe I would need to kind of constrain myself to a more broad interpretation of the characters, this kind of things that are always true. And they said, no, go deep, go specific. That's what you're known for. That's what we're looking for. And I was happy to oblige.
All right, there's a couple of things I want to underline. First of all, I want to make sure it's clear to anyone that he's planning on just going over to a studio right now with a hard drive, expecting them to hand over the art, that it was you were already working on a book, you'd already had published a couple of books. So you were established. Not just anyone can go up to the studio and get that kind of freedom. The other thing I want to
I certainly wouldn't advise trying it. No, I had I had a license. I was working with IDW Publishing. I had, people at Hasbro sent me over there. I had made contact with the showrunners. I mean, it was a planned meeting with emails and paper trails and all the sort of good stuff.
The other thing I want to underline is how this all started with a GoBots anecdote that you were watching GoBots, and then it just blew so far past GoBots in a way that is very like in line with the actual arc of the GoBots Transformers relationship, that they were there first, but they are long overshadowed by what Transformers became.
And that's not an accident. And I've known as someone who's in the GoBots fandom, and I love GoBots, and I have a bunch of GoBots original art, and I've chatted with people who used to work at Tonka and worked on the GoBots line. I think GoBots are great, but Hasbro really had this winning formula that they perfected with G.I. Joe, and where they were producing, in the late 70s and early 80s, they were producing these wonderful toys, and then they were getting completely blown away by Kenner and their shitty Star Wars toys. And that's not sort of my opinion. That's the opinion of the toy execs. It's like, why are these, 3-inch tall, badly sculpted? Why are they outselling this? And they realized, it was very much around the narrative. And what they needed was to create their own narrative. And they did that for G.I. Joe, and they did it in the comic books, and then they brought it to commercials, and then they brought it to miniseries, and eventually they brought it to television as full seasons. And that worked so well in the early 80s that they rolled that same formula out to Transformers to great success, and then to other properties with varying degrees of success. And Gem went quite a few years and quite a few seasons. Other things like Inhumanoids or Visionaries were, they flared and went away a lot more quickly. But they certainly hit on a pretty amazing way to flesh out, pun intended, I guess, these characters, these Transformers and G.I. Joe soldiers. And they brought in Marvel to flesh out the backstory. It was Larry Hama writing the bios for the G.I. Joe characters. It was Bob Budiansky who was doing it for the Transformers characters. And they put the bios on the package, and then they were more or less true to those sort of bios across the comic books and across the television shows that they did and the movies that they did. And they were super ambitious, and it paid off. To do a Jurassic Park, they spared no expense. They hired the best artists to do beautiful airbrushed renderings of the robots in the style of the Takara, which was the company that was partnering with Hasbro in Japan on their side of things. Because the first couple of years of Transformers were licensed, and that's not something G.I. Joe had going on. But for Transformers, they brought over toys that Takara and a few other companies, but mostly Takara, had produced. And that's what made the core of the Transformers brands. Starscream and Megatron. Starscream came out of the Diaclone line. Megatron, Soundwave came out of the Microchange line, which is a fun gimmick. Microchange was characters, action heroes that were 3.5 inches tall. So your toys were life size. And the Microchange was a spin-off of that. And it was all the sort of role-play toys, the Megatrons and Soundwaves and Blaster and Perceptor and whatnot.
In the same way that Hasbro was looking at Kenner and what they were doing with Star Wars, I'm sure, I don't even remember, it was Tonka? Did they do GoBots?
Yes, and okay. They licensed it from Bandai, which had put them out as Machine Robo, the 600 series.
So
and they were called the 600 series because they cost 600 yen, which is about...
Makes sense.
Yeah, which is about $3 at the time.
I just remember that GoBots, they are to scale with Hot Wheels and Matchbox, so they really could feel like they could blend in and you could use all the other cars as civilians. And then you had Transformers, where it's like, here's the pistol, and he's taller than the jet fighter. And it's like, the GoBot people must have been like, this makes no sense. Why do the kids love it? And it's because, like you said, the storytelling was all around it, and is like, sometimes they justified it, and sometimes just through animation where... Okay, Megatron can shrink. We are never going to explain this in continuity on the series, but you see it happen, you fill in the gaps as the viewer and the kid with the toy who then has to justify why their Megatron is in charge of what should be much larger robots.
They also took a lot more liberties with the designs. The Hanna-Barbera character models are very, very close to the GoBots toys, which probably the Tonka executives saw as a positive, right? Because, you know, you could, you know, in a sense, it's more easier to imagine Copter, the character, is Copter your toy, because they both have the face sticking out the bottom. Transformers, you know, went to great trouble to conceal all the faces that might be visible if they were visible in the toy form. Not that they had a lot of that going on, but they certainly, you know, probably Ratchet and Ironhide would be the best example of characters where they very much heroed up the toy into a design that was much more humanistic than the weird sort of Diaclone forklifts that had little operators going on. And they brought in Flora Derry to do the designs of the first couple of seasons and the Transformers the movie. And, you know, he would streamline those toys. A lot of times, you know, wheels on the shoulder of the toys would go away, or Optimus Prime's wheels on his torso, his lower torso would go away. I actually have a very early animation cell of Optimus Prime where they hadn't gotten rid of the wheels yet. They might have gotten rid of the wheels on his torso, but they kept the ones on the legs, which eventually would vanish from the final design. So
all right. So we've talked a lot about your Transformers credibility, your credentials. But before you worked on Essence 20, you didn't have any gaming writing experience, but you have done a fair amount of gaming in your life, right?
Oh yeah, I've been gaming since I was, I don't know, 8 or 9. I started playing, you know, Dungeons and Dragons and the various, you know, the colorful boxes that you'd get and open them up. And then they went to Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, and I got to feel very grown up. But yeah, I mean, it's been an element in my life for a long time. I did a lot of gaming in college. And then when I, every time I've moved, I've always tried to find a gaming group in the city I'm in, just as a way to socialize and make some friends and, you know, express the creativity. When we first started the Zoom, I had my character's name in the bottom of it.
No, we're not going to talk about your character. Just that's too deep of a rabbit hole. That's too much of a
tangent. No. We don't. I mean, I feel like talking about your current D&D characters is not interesting to anyone but the people who are actually in the group.
So I'm curious though. So you're an active gamer. You hear about a Transformers role playing game coming out. How come it took somebody else to put the connection of you should be working on this?
It's a fair question. I tend to reach out to publishers that I already have some sort of connection to, if I already know the editor in question or I've worked with someone. So cold calling is always kind of a tricky proposition. I mean, at least for me, you know, I've done it. I've been in that position, and I've had success in it. I mean, you have to start somewhere. But at this point, it's not uncommon for someone to come to me with a project. You know, it's at least as common for that as for me to pitch something to a publisher. So it didn't necessarily occur to me that they would be interested in having me, especially because I'm not great on like the crunch side of things. You know, like I'm very much the player in the group. I'm not the GM in the group or the storyteller in the group. So, you know, I can be, I was a math guy in my former life. My day job when I had one was doing data analytics, and I studied math in college. So I can be like a really, you know, almost pernicious min-maxer. I try to guard against that tendency a little bit, but I kind of can't help but see the synergies and at least lean into them a little bit. I remember once doing a campaign, a Dungeons and Dragons 3.5 campaign, and we had a total party wipe, and we shouldn't have, but we did. And we were way at the end of an adventure path and you know, that we'd been playing for like 2 years. And so we decided that we would keep going, but we had to generate new like 20th level characters. And we'd been playing I'd been playing my existing guy since level 3. So he had all the sort of foibles that you get as you naturally level someone up and you're using found gear because it's sort of just cheaper than selling it and buying it back and whatnot. And now I was given like level 20 recommended wealth to buy whatever I wanted, and I had the chance to, and I wound up making a Warforged monk, just straight level 20 monk, and all the feats and weapon finesse, and he was all dex based, and the GM said, look, I think maybe Caius, the god, might be able to hit your character, but I don't think anything else in the rest of the adventure will. Can you tone it down, please? I'm like, okay, I will get rid of weapon finesse, and I will add some brain
There
things.
you go.
And that will, and, well, it did. Like, it's amazing how much like a little change like that can. And it wasn't nerfed. I mean, it was a really tough build, but not quite broken the way he was before. So I do try to guard against that. But despite that, I've never, tried my hand at writing the mechanics so much. And I wasn't sure that was something that I would have aptitude for or interest in. But with Essence 20, I was mostly doing the, I've done some of the perks, but mostly, and a little bit of gear, but mostly I've been on the lore side of things. And that suits me just fine, because I can play with Transformers lore, until the mecha cows come home.
So your first published credit with Essence 20 is Enigma of Combination. What state was it with, excuse me, what state was it in when you got brought on board?
So I was brought on board with a bunch of other freelancers, and I believe it was in the outline stage, and they were sort of assigning different parts to different people, and they had sort of defaulted me to lore. And like I said, that kind of suited me just fine. And I really just wrote, probably about two-thirds of chapter one, if I'm remembering correctly. I wrote sort of an introduction to the idea of what a combiner was, and I and it was combiners, and it was the masters, the little guys that turn into heads and guns and stuff, and we walked through some of those, and I tried to do it in a way that was in universe, so it was sort of found documents and lectures and whatnot that might exist. I find that's a format that can really draw people in, because it has that narrative element that I think is really appealing. It avoids, when lore is presented in a dry factual way, it reads like an encyclopedia. Like there's a reason that most people don't wind up reading the appendices of Tolkien. And Tolkien is brilliant, and Tolkien's world building is brilliant. But I would much rather, as a reader, engage with it, when it's presented as part of the story, as opposed to, at the end of the book, and here's a list of facts. Because at the end of the day, it's a list of things that didn't really happen. And if you don't have that story context, it, to me, it's harder to grab onto it. So I, in my work, I try to provide, at least some element of story context. And the other advantage of having a character present the information is, whenever you're talking or writing, you're not just talking or writing about your subject, you're talking or writing about yourself. You can't help but reveal things about yourself. You're learning all about me, even when I'm not talking about me, and vice versa. So if I have Cheetor talk about beasts, if I have Mindwipe talk about headmasters, you're learning about Cheetor. You're learning about Mindwipe. And you get that little bit of extra value to it. And character voices are fun to play with. And Transformers and G.I. Joe have especially fun voices, because they're so exaggerated. There's a heightened reality to them that it can be very appealing. They have verbal tics. Like we were talking about how Lugnut always, took, everything he says is about Megatron. And real people don't. Even people that are really fanatic about a baseball team or a politician or a role-playing game, they can and do talk about other things from time to time. But for a Transformer, I mean, it's in their programming. But it's okay to have that exaggerated reality.
It also feels like
No, not
Enigma.
that it's
Sorry, go
fun to
ahead.
have. It's fun to have exaggerated reality. It adds to the experience, and I think it adds to the role-playing experience. Because you can take an existing character and play into their foibles and their tics, or you could make an existing character that has brand new foibles and tics. And when I was working on Transformers in a narrative capacity, I delighted in making new characters or taking new old characters that didn't have any fiction and trying to find those Buddy Anski-ish tics to them. I had a character that only spoke in trans in Simpsons quotes, and he got a really positive response. And I remember somebody saying, "Well, how'd you come up with that?" I'm like, "Dude, I know I've met that guy in real life." And I think we all have. I think we've all met the person who, like, they're, I mean, now I'm probably dating myself, but I remember, like, in the early days of gaming, there'd be people that, like, every word out of their mouth was a Monty Python quote, you know? And it's fine and it's funny, but, you know, it could get old, but not when it's coming out of a robot jet.
So I also think the Enigma of Combination was a good book to bring you on because the very concept and the toys that it is focusing on, it's much more of a I get why this is a cool toy than it is I get why this makes sense in the world of Transformers.
I think that they struggled with that right from the beginning, right? Because Hasbro, I mentioned Hasbro had licensed the first couple of years of the Transformers toys from Takara in Japan, but then eventually they ran out of toys to license and they had to start coming up with their own. And they started leaning more heavily into, like, line-wide gimmicks. And, you know, 1987, the Headmasters and the Target Masters were really the first year that they were fully committed to that idea. And, you know, you had robots who had their heads turn into a little man, or their gun turn into a little man. And it's definitely, I mean, it's a cool toy. You know, it's fun to fiddle with it. But then why would they do that? You know, why would these robots decide to do that? You know, and Bob Budiansky over at Marvel had to come up with the reasons why they were doing that. And he did it, you know, at the sort of mile high level with a, like, a 2-page memo where he's outlining that it, you know, it enhances their speed and their capabilities. And then he did it as a 4-issue comic book where, you know, you actually see the story of the Autobots going to Nebulos and trying to make peace with the natives and offering up their heads as tribute, which is a bizarre image, but, you know, they're robots. I guess you can get away with it. Well, I mean, they did, right? Because, you know, here we are 30 years later and we're still sort of engaging with those ideas and making characters and rule sets based on it. So yeah, I get where you're coming from. It's a more esoteric idea than, I guess, the comparatively straightforward idea of this robot can turn into a car, which is also an objectively awesome idea, but it's a more straightforward one, isn't it?
The car goes faster, but why do I want to play a leg? Like I'm here, I'm with a group of friends. I get why I would want to be a wizard or a barbarian. I get why I would want to be a commando or a technician, but why do I want to be a leg? That feels like it needed someone who really gets what being a leg is to that Transformer.
And I guess in any role-playing group, there's going to be that sort of compact about, like, you know, what is the experience at the table going to be, you know, and are is the whole, you know, is our five, you know, 6-member group with one game master and 5 players, are we all gonna, like, be the combiner? And then when we're combined, are we going to, you know, quickly have a powwow and decide what our actions are? Or, you know, am I the leg, the only combiner in the team? In which case, you know, maybe when we combine, I get to play the super robot. You know, I mean, those sort of collaborative storytellings, I think, are what could make gaming pretty magical. You know,
It is
because
also
I
something that it was not, it was like alluded to in the core rulebook, but it really wasn't explored mechanically until the Enigma of Combination. And all that time, fans were asking, like, when are we going to get combiners? So with that much like anticipation for this book, how do you feel it was received?
Well, from what I could tell, people really, really ate it up. I mean, when it came out, you know, I was lurking on all the boards, and you'll forgive me, but you know, I was very focused on, like, are they going to enjoy the storytelling aspects? And they really seemed to engage with that in ways that were gratifying and, you know, put whatever, you know, doubts I had at ease. And I was, I think, more confident going into Techno-Organic Secrets. But certainly, it seems like like from what I can see on the boards, people very much engage mechanically with the rule sets as well, which is what you want. And, you know, there's the people like me, Shane, who are, you know, looking for ways to min-max. And I've seen some of that with like techno-organic secrets. They're like, oh man, if I make myself a horse, I can get access to the equestrian feats. And, you know, and part of me is like rolling my eyes, but part of me is like, okay, respect. I see where you're coming from.
Well, so not that they need to be defended, but I will say that probably the reason you're seeing that is that you could talk about Transformers in a million places online, but you can only talk about the Transformers role-playing game on a much smaller, you know, field of options. And so that's where you're seeing that kind of conversation, because they probably already have their venues for the lore discussions that they also engage in on the Renegade Discord and the Facebook and whatnot. But yeah, it is really like, this is our chance to have this conversation with our people.
Oh yeah, and no disrespect or judgment was implied. I mean, like, this is exactly where, and I love talking about role-playing mechanics. You know, I mean, like, I really like finding those synergies and hopefully not breaking the game, but, you know, like finding that clever way to use that mechanic, you know, I get it. Like, that's fun. And part of the fun of having a system is that you have multiple books, you know, written by probably multiple authors. And, you know, sometimes that equestrian feat, if you put it on like a transformer, like Mach Kick, who's a horse, you know, he's a canonical Beast Wars horse, like that can be fun, you know, like that can be really interesting. You know, G.I. Joe feats, you know, can be used on some of these Transformers characters. You know, I mean, Transformers and G.I. Joe have had, you know, so many crossovers, you know, and I mean, way as far back as the Marvel comics and the Transformers TV show, they were having little nods to each other. I mean, Marissa Fairborn is Flint's daughter, you know, Old Snake shows up in the Transformers season 5, taking advantage of the fact that it's 20 years in the future. I mean, like, these properties can mesh very well together. Thematically, they could mesh very well together, because, you know, they were exploring kind of similar themes and similar ideas.
Well, you are talking to the person that's done most of the crossover stuff that we have produced through Renegade, and that is just some of the most fun stuff that I've put out. One thing in the Field Guide to Action Adventure, I'm not going to talk too much about my stuff, but this is one thing that I think you'll appreciate, is that when I realized that in the first crop of Power Rangers, there was a Tommy and there was a Kim, and Storm Shadow is Tommy and Jinx is Kim, and I was like, oh, I could do some kind of like, the Tommies are teaming up against the Kims, a Tommy and a Kim is against it. And so there's just a little paragraph about like, these are the connections that are there, and it's just, it is a wide open toy box for you to play with right now.
That ethos, the toy box ethos, like that's the energy I try to bring almost to all my Transformers work. Like, you can do Transformers in a very rigid way and say, okay, and sometimes it's appropriate to do that. When I was doing the Transformers, you know, G1 character model books, everything in there was a G1 character model. You know, there was no expanding beyond that because the scope was defined. But I love that Transformers has had so many different incarnations and iterations, and that Transformers can be a story where it's, you know, largely about sort of the human military who's teaming up with the Transformers, or it can be about, you know, basically superheroes in outer space having, you know, Greek mythology, or, you know, I mean, it can be so many and has been so many different things. It can be about guys whose heads turn into little robots, you know, it can be bot-bots, you know, it can be, you know, transforming toilets and popsicles. I mean, like, these are all this and more are things Transformers has been, like, Japanese, you know, sexy girls. Transformers has been, I mean, it's been lots and lots and lots of things.
We don't talk about kiss players.
But they're, like you could avoid the skeezy stuff, and there's still interesting lore to be drawn from that. And it still informs what's going on in like the Japanese G1 continent. Because for all the Transformers in America kind of exploded into dozens of different directions, in Japan, they very much tried to sort of tie everything back to that original cartoon that went many more years in Japan than it went in America. So like lots and lots of things that feel like they're tangents in America get looped back in some strange, fan running the inmates running the asylum sort of ways. And I think that's pretty glorious too. Like I love all you said Transformers is pretty great, right? I mean, it is. And one of the things that makes it great is, how multitudinous it can be.
Which brings us to Techno-Organic Secrets, which kind of is the first time that Transformers got a major reboot. It like completely reset the concept. I'm sorry, this book is focusing on largely that timeline. So you were once again brought in not only as a writer but also as the Transformers lore consultant. So can you talk about just the different hats that you wore for this project and how you approached it differently from Enigma of Combination?
Well, so at first I started in very much the same way. We got an outline. I was assigned the first chapter, and I was also assigned to write a bunch of character bios, which was an expansion about what I did. And I got to do a little bit of the crunch, which was fun for me. I got to write up a couple of perks. I think I did two heads is better than one for
Nice.
guys who have two heads going on. And I the mechanics were harder for me. I'll be totally upfront about that. And I workshop that more with my friends. I'm like, okay, so I'm thinking it'll give a bonus to alertness. Is that good? They're like, it's good, but you need more. I'm like, okay, and then we came up and you can give yourself a help action like once a scene. I did the hybridizer feat because I really wanted to get the sort of animal themed robots from the Robots in Disguise cartoon in there. I did a double spy one because we that's something that's been with Transformers since 87. But I thought, oh, let's explore that mechanically. One of the Beast guys has that going on, so it felt like a natural fit. And I got to write up the Golden Disc, which was one of the giant MacGuffins from the Beast Wars cartoon. And I said, okay, well that's fun. We can talk about that. So that was fun for me to have an expanded role. And they came to me later and said, would you be interested in coming in sort of more of an editorial role and just going through and giving notes on any of the lore things? So I said, yeah, sure, I can do that. And I mean, it wasn't that. I mean, I wound up doing it, I think, over the course of a weekend or maybe 3 or 4 days. It didn't take that long to kind of read through all the book. And honestly, like everybody had turned in really good work at the Dinobots chapter. I specifically flagged. I'm like every word of this chapter is excellent. Whoever has done this like really loves and really gets the Dinobots. This is a joy to read. No notes, no notes. But like little spelling errors, I picked up like not the kind of thing that you'd pick up with a spell check because it's how a character's name is parsed. If it's
I'll admit
one
I
word,
misspelled Blur's name in the core rulebook because there should be
it
two R's.
happens. It happens. I think I misspelled Onslaught in my first book, and I just assumed there'd be copy editing, and there wasn't. And I just like, and I know how to spell Onslaught, but I fat fingered it, and it's there. Like, I think I fixed it for the combined edition, but if you get the they never like changed it up. So even though they went to a second printing, it still has the spelling error in there. It's like, argh! That's all. Sometimes all you see is the flaws, right? But I again, when they asked me if I'd do it, I'd say sure, I'd be happy to. But I wasn't sure if I was going to be providing value. And they sent me three PDFs. They sent me like the first half of the book, the second half of the book, and like the cover. The front and back cover and the spine. So I started with that because it was like one page, and they got the name of the book wrong.
Oh.
Because I'm reading it and they're like, you'll find that the Enigma of Combination. I'm like, all right, I literally just
Oh.
justified myself. Like I felt good about it. Like it's not in the final version. I found it. I fixed it. I flagged it. It's good. But like I said, okay, I have justified my salary immediately. I'm not happy that, and I can see it's a cut and paste error. I mean,
Yeah.
they grabbed the text from the last one, they forgot to update.
Right.
But yeah, I went through and just wrote up little notes. I think the biggest contribution I had was I noted that there's just a lot of redundancy around the perks for sort of like the Transmetal 2 and the Beast Mutants and the Techno-Organic guys. Like sometimes the same perk would show up two or three times, and it was because it could go to any of them. And I had suggested, we could consolidate this, and I wrote up a couple extra perks, just to fill in space, because I said, in case you need them, here are a few. And they want, I don't remember if they used the perks I wrote up, but they definitely consolidated them. And then, a couple of the I forget the term for it, but there's like 12 different like for different sub factions, there's like 12 different influences they could have, I think,
Sure.
or yeah. I think for one or two of those, I wound up flagging it, and I said, there's nothing wrong with this, but it's not, to me, it doesn't feel thematical, compared to some of the other ones. And I wound up suggesting ch changes, and they wound up using some of those. And again, none of these were mistakes, right? It was more just like, I could see a place where this might, make the book, just a little bit better, a little bit closer to that ideal. And I like doing that, because when you're something about a book as opposed to like a website or the more ephemeral forms of information, you get one shot really to do it, and then it's done. And you really want it to have everything it should and nothing it shouldn't, and hopefully like no typos. And I like being a part of that process. And I could, it really seemed like everyone at Renegade really cared. Nobody was phoning it in. It wasn't, a product to make a buck. I mean, it's a product and they want to make money, but
Yes.
like you could, well, at the
Renegade
cheap.
doesn't want to lose money on these books.
No. But you could tell that it's done with passion, love, and care, and that matters.
So, would you come back for another source book if you were asked?
I would absolutely come back for another source book if I was asked, and I have some ideas about what it could be.
Oh,
But
nice. So, I will tell you that Renegade Rewards Initiative. So I have
okay.
presented ideas with them, and now there are books because I presented those ideas just on my own initiative. So
All right.
if you've got an idea and you'd love to work on it,
No,
talk
I
to
mean,
your editors, your
it's
developers.
been a terrific experience. I mean, no lie, I love the Transformers brand. I love the mythology. I love the weird little corners of it. I like delving into it, but then I like just the big mass market stuff. I just like today I got a Sentinel Prime from the Transformers One movie. I thought he kind of stole the show, so I tracked him down. And I love the big guys too. I mean, the Optimuses, the Megatron, the Grimlocks, and the Bumblebees. Like all of them, they add up to something, greater than the sum of its parts. And I think a role playing game is a perfect microcosm of that, because you can do that yourself. You could do that as a player. You can do that as a storyteller. You can pull those elements in and then interact with them in unexpected ways, mechanically and narratively. And I love that. I love that about gaming. I love that about the writing and the fiction, the fandom, the creativity, the output, the costumes and the customs. I mean, all of that stuff. It's such a rewarding thing to be a part of.
So when are you going to run a campaign or participate in a campaign if you can get a GM?
I mean, I'd be happy to do that. I feel like the hard part in the I'm in two gaming groups right now, but both of them are doing Dungeons and Dragons. And it's not like I like other systems too. I certainly, having written for Essence 20, it'd be really fun to play in a campaign. I loved Cortex. I thought that was I really loved like the die pool mechanics. I thought that was great. I mean, the one roll engine I thought was a very ambitious system. It didn't quite work with our group. That doesn't mean it couldn't work with somebody else's group. But like, I like seeing how you can represent these ideas mathematically. I don't know if it was in the interview or before the interview, but before I was a full-time writer, I was a data analyst, and my mind can really I can really visualize numbers. I can kind of feel the difference between, 1,000 and 1,000,000. And that's I don't think everybody has that. And it it's something that makes gaming pretty interesting because I think there's a part of human nature that's like, oh, I only fail on a one, so I basically can never fail. But you're gonna roll a one. I mean, it's gonna happen, right? I mean, it's gonna happen one time in 20, and you're gonna roll the die more than 20 times. So like you're gonna hit that one. I play XCOM on the computer, and it'll show you the percent, and you'll have like a 98% shot, and sometime you're gonna miss because you're gonna do
What?
more
What are
than 50
the
times. Yeah, I mean low, but low
odds?
isn't zero, is it? And that can add the spice because sometimes you fail when like you shouldn't, and sometimes you succeed when you shouldn't. I remember like one of my earliest role playing experiences was at a convention in Long Island, like in the 80s or maybe early 90s, and I had a pre-gen paladin, and and we're low level, I don't know, four or five, something like that, and like a demon appeared, and I'm like, I charge forward and I try to turn him, and they're like, well, that's not gonna work. And then I rolled a 20. It's like,
Oh.
oh, the paladin banishes the demon, and I felt like a mile tall. I mean, there was such a, and I was, I mean, I was young, I was over 13, I felt like on top of the world. I felt like I banished this demon, and the fact that it was so unlikely added that spice. But if I did it 19 more times, I'd fail most of them, wouldn't I?
So I do warn you before you get into your first Transformers game, at least my experience is when I'm playing in a game that I've designed, I cannot take the designer hat off. And I am just sitting there being like, oh, you know what this build needs? This build needs something that I gotta add to the next book. Or just like, yeah, oh, now I see how that thing I designed doesn't work as I intended, or has like a little just a little thing to it that I could probably have tweaked out. And I'm just quieter in games when I'm running or when I'm playing in an SN20 game because the engine is running.
I can very much see that. And I think for me, the mechanics that I was kind of proud of designing were all stuff where I felt like there is lore around this, and I would like players to be able to mechanically engage with this lore. I would like this to be a thing, not just for flavor, but also for the crunch of it, and that's, whatever the next book winds up being, if there's another book, I suspect that's where my mind is going to go. It's going to be like, oh, I love that this character exists, that I don't know, double pretenders exist, and like, but how, what would that look like in the game? Are you do you need two players to collaborate and we're both inside one shell? Or no, that doesn't sound quite right. And you noodle around with it until eventually you kind of come up with an idea that says, oh, that'll work. That's how you do it. That's how you borrow this mechanic from over here, and you stack them. But that's the fun of it, is this, as the systems grow and more options present themselves and more factions and influences and origins present themselves, you get to do that. And I like translating it back to the toys. We were chatting on one of the message boards about, like hard points and external ones and in their robot modes, and I wound up posting a picture of a two-headed, just coincidentally, Terracon, who had a big 5mm port on his back, stick a big gun. It's like, clearly, that's what this mechanic is, at its core essence. This thing from a 35-year-old toy is what we're trying to capture with the game.
All right, well, Jim, this has been amazing. Before we sign off, is there anything that you want to draw attention to? Anything you want to shout out?
Just it's been an absolute pleasure, getting to interact with some of the fans of Essence 20. I'm really grateful they brought me on, and I hope we're doing more of this. Maybe we're chatting on a podcast in a year about the next project.
I look forward to that. This has been awesome.
Yeah, real pleasure.
All right, well, until next time, I'm Ryan Costello. This has been Upshift. Finally back in the world to continue my service. Lonzo would assure me that this was my new purpose. With a team of green shirt, highly trained specialists. Kept it to myself, told the others don't question it. Trust me, some things are better left unsaid. Except my demons.